Welcome to another episode of Up My Nursing Game. To all my nurses listening to this episode, be sure to claim 1 hour of continuing education for free by going to upmynursinggame.bcuhealth.org. I have a great interview for you today with an interventional radiologist, but before we dive into the interview, I have an important announcement. Up My Nursing Game has partnered with, drumroll please, Stoggles! I can't believe my little podcast is growing up and getting sponsored. It's crazy how far it's come along in just a year, but I've been holding out until I found a brand that I feel totally okay with, and I'm 100% happy to have Stoggles on board. In case you've been living in a cave, Stoggles are glasses that protect like goggles. My hospital, like most in this country, require all patient-facing employees to wear eye protection when interacting with patients, and Stoggles have been the goggle of choice for staff at my hospital. They look great on both men and women, they don't fog up, and they protect your eyes not only from COVID, but from all the other nursing unpleasantries, like your patient coughing in your face, and from projectile G-tube situations. So head over to wearstoggles.com and use the promo code UMNG10 for 10% off your order. This is all in the show notes too. Okay, back to interventional radiology. Honestly, I hadn't even heard of IR until I worked in a hospital. So, for our newbie nurse listeners, IR is a subspecialty that performs minimally invasive procedures using real-time imaging, such as X-ray fluoroscopy and ultrasound. Some common IR procedures include thoracentesis, nephrostomies, biliary drains, temporary dialysis catheters. The list goes on and on. So, today's guest, Dr. Amrit Hansra, is an interventional radiologist. We'll be going over some radiology basics before we dive into various IR procedures and what nurses need to know about caring for patients with all of the catheters, drains, and stents placed under IR. Listen in. All right. Welcome, Dr. Amrit Hansra, to the show today. Dr. Hansra is an interventional radiologist. He completed his residency in diagnostic radiology at the University of Arizona and then further subspecialized in interventional radiology at UCLA. He's currently working as an attending physician in Northern California, where he was also born and raised. All right. Welcome to the show, Dr. Hansra.
Thank you, Annie. Really appreciate you having me. This is very exciting to talk to you, talk to your fans, and talk to the listeners out there and kind of discuss what interventional radiology is and how it pertains to nursing.
Yeah, I'm excited too. And when I thought about having you on the show previously, I thought like, I don't know what to really talk to interventional radiologist about as a nurse. And then as soon as I started speaking with you, I was like, oh my God, what can't we talk about? There's so much that nurses need to know and understand about interventional radiology. So, I look forward to the discussion today. Before we kind of dive into interventional radiology, tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, what are you doing when you're not in the hospital or not in clinic?
So that is a great question. When am I not in the hospital? When am I not right. <in clinic? laughs>
Right.
But yes, on those rare occasions, those rare weekends like today, I do enjoy outdoor hiking. I do enjoy going to the gym, working out as much as I can. I've taken up photography. I don't know if that's because I kind of have an eye as a diagnostic radiologist and we see images all the time. I'm not sure if that's how it developed or I went into radiology because I've always had passion for photography. Not sure.
There's something kind of like nerdy about photography. And I'm speaking as someone who's married to a nerd that, you know, there's so much you can learn and tinker with photography.
Yes,
that I think it really like resonates with the people who are technical.
Yeah. I'm not, you know, an expert by any means, but I do love, you know, landscape photography. I've tried portraits as well. It's fun. It's fun getting out there as well, getting out into the environment, just outdoors and seeing what you can capture.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of an antidote in a way to hospital life, just to get out there and use your, draw on your, the creative side of your brain.
Agreed. And then finally actually get my vitamin D levels up. Yeah. All day long. Yeah,
naturally.
Yes, exactly.
And, one thing I was interested to learn about you is that you are really interested in public speaking and even comedy, and that you perform at an open mic night.
Yes, I've always had a passion for public speaking. This is dated back to, I couldn't even tell you when. And I think back in high school, we did a lot of speech competitions, going to states and nationals. And then that's just kind of carried throughout the years as well. I've done a lot of talks throughout the years. Pretty much now it's all related to medical. And, interventional radiology, definitely. And then when I was in residency, I think it was during studying for my boards, I believe it was, that I needed an outlet, basically. And, I said, you know what, let's try my hand at, open mic comedy nights. And I started doing that. This was back in Tucson, Arizona. This was pre-COVID. And I really enjoyed it. I had such a fun time. It was great. And hoping to get back there soon, now that things are slowly starting to open up again. Hopefully we can get back to a point where, things are allowing me to start that passion up again.
Yeah, I'm so impressed by that. I obviously don't mind public speaking too much. I host this podcast. But trying to be funny, like on command, that is like a whole nother level that I just have a lot of respect for.
It gives me a whole new appreciation for comedians because they,
And they all talk about how they've had total flops where they're up there performing and no one's laughing. And one experience of that and I would be out, but they just go back and do it again. And I'm so
the
impressed.
The perseverance. Absolutely. I mean, I had that moment at one of the open mic nights. I thought the joke was killer. I got literally nothing. Okay. Back to the drawing board.
Were you laughing at it?
No, at that moment, no. Okay. Absolutely not. Yeah. A couple of days later. Yes. This is a little funny, but no. Yeah. You start sweating bullets.
Yeah. But that's really cool. And it's neat to know that you have this whole other part of your life outside of the hospital.
Yeah, it's fun. It is fun.
So kind of going back to radiology here, can you talk about, what goes into the training of being an interventional radiologist and why you chose that specialty in medicine?
After medical school, you end up doing a year of internship. And that's essentially, it could be medicine, surgery, there's a transitional year. I ended up doing internal medicine for the year. And then it's 4 years of diagnostic radiology. And I should put the caveat here, this is the traditional way of getting to IR. There are some new pathways now. But the traditional pathway that I chose was 4 years of diagnostic radiology after 1 year of internship. So that's a total of 5 years now. And then you go and further subspecialize in IR, which was another year after that. So 6 years total. The reason I chose going into this field, first of all, I absolutely love diagnostic radiology. And I say the story all the time. You essentially know so much about the patient by just looking at a CT scan. I mean, I can tell you if the patient's diabetic, hypertensive. I can tell you if they're on dialysis, if they're nearing dialysis. I can tell you if they've been drinking acutely, if they have a chronic drinking problem. Can tell you what else. I mean, if they've had, lower abdominal pain for years, back pain, where exactly the back pain is, where it radiates. And I love that aspect. And number two, as a diagnostic radiologist, and even as an IR, you quite literally deal with all specialties in the hospital. Not a lot of other specialties can say that. I may 1 minute be talking to an OBGYN about some fibroids that are bleeding, and then I immediately switch gears to talking to a surgeon about a gallbladder that the patient's too unstable to go to the OR, immediately switch gears at that point and talk to a patient about radiculopathy and some back pain that they're having. and neurosurgeons requesting that. And, you know, the list goes on and on. So I truly love that aspect of the field. And then as an IR, to be able to not only look at the imaging and diagnose whatever it is on the imaging, but to also treat it in a minimally invasive approach. After the majority of my procedures, the patients just go to recovery. Either they're, you know, laying flat for maybe 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. And usually it's an outpatient procedure that they can get discharged the same day. And, you know, you compare that to maybe open surgery and the recovery time. So that's another aspect that I truly appreciate about this field.
Did you ever feel like this weight as a radiologist, sorry, as a diagnostic radiologist, mm-hmm. that what you write in your radiology report is then used to make so many clinical decisions that
yes.
like there's this weight, I would imagine, that you have to be sure of what you're seeing because that's going to influence the treatment of the patient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Your dictation as a diagnostic radiologist will not only influence the patient's inpatient care and will start to, you know, get the ball rolling for whatever it may be as far as treatment wise, surgery, conservative management, whatever therapy. But then that's in the patient's chart forever. You know, if you incorrectly diagnose a patient with, say, chronic pancreatitis or, say, a renal artery stenosis or whatever it may be, that's in the patient's chart and they will carry that with them. And if you incorrectly diagnose a lung nodule and you say that, well, this may look malignant and, you know, they go get biopsied, surgery after that, it turned out to be a hematoma, which you can diagnose on CT, which is completely benign. That's pretty severe. So yes, you feel that weight as a diagnostic radiologist every read. And not only, you know, if you're doing an 8 hour shift, I remember this back in residency, you do an 8 hour shift, call shift, and you need to be on your A game every single study. It's not because, you know, you're nearing the eighth hour that you start relaxing. Yes, you're tired. No, because you may have the most complicated CT in the eighth hour. And you have to give it just as much attention as if it were that first hour.
So I'm not surprised that you made that extra step from becoming a diagnostic radiologist to an interventional, because when I've in my mind, I don't think I've ever met a diagnostic radiologist because they're always kind of somewhere else in the hospital away from people. And I imagine kind of in a dark room all day. I don't know if that's accurate at all, but I think it would be like such a great position for an introvert, but you're obviously not. You're extroverted. You like, you know, hands-on working with people. So I'm entirely surprised that you chose interventional radiology.
Yeah, I love getting out there. I love talking to clinicians, patients. You know, I have clinic every week and I'm talking to patients every week in clinic. I love getting out on the floors, rounding on patients and interacting with different specialties, going over game plans for patient care, talking to families after the procedure, before the procedure. I really appreciate that aspect of the field as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So now would be a good time to go in and could you just talk about like what is interventional radiology and how does it differ from, for example, like vascular surgery, like, and where are the overlaps and like where does vascular surgery end and IR begin?
Yeah. So it's a very complicated question because of a couple of different factors. And one being is our name, interventional radiology, it doesn't really showcase what we do like other specialties, OBGYN. Yes, you know exactly what they're going to do. Pediatrics, you know exactly what they're doing. Vascular surgery, you know what they're doing. And the list goes on and on. GI, whatever it may be. But our specialty, interventional radiology, well, then you don't really know what's going on. So that's number one. And then number two, the reason that this can be a little complicated is we do, a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Throughout the body, other than, and this is exactly how I explain it to my patients, other than the brain and the heart, my catheters are going everywhere else in the body. Quite literally. I mean, from head, or I should say from neck to toe, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's wherever I can get a catheter, a wire, I will go there. And that's one aspect of it. So that's the vascular aspect of it, whether it be veins, arteries, even lymphatics. That's a vascular aspect of it. Everything we do is minimally invasive. There's a caveat to that as well. I can get to that bit. And the majority of what we do is minimally invasive. So you're asking, you know, when does vascular, is there an overlap with us? Well, they do open repair as well. Yes, they do a lot of endovascular work. Well, so we do share that endovascular, approach with patients. But if it comes to an open repair or an open surgery, whatever it may be, that's obviously them. We don't do that. We do a lot more microcatheter work. So there's larger catheters where you can get into the larger artery, say the common femoral artery or, somewhere in the aorta, the renal artery, but we do a lot of microcatheter work. So through that artery, we can subselect multiple different smaller arteries, you know, a few millimeters in size, and get to exactly and pinpoint where we need to go. So that's one whole aspect of IR, which is the vascular aspect of it. Then, I mean, the list can go, I can spend a whole hour talking about this. Then there's the pain management aspect of it. I do a lot of back pain, radiculopathy, and I do a lot of epidural injections. I do a lot of spinal stimulator implants for back pain. Then there's the whole aspect of percutaneous approach. And what does that mean? Well, if I need to get a biopsy, somebody, you know, if there's an adrenal nodule, if there's a liver nodule, okay, well, we can percutaneously get to it using ultrasound, CT, whatever it may be. Then there's the oncology aspect of it. Somebody has an HCC. Well, what can we do for that? Not only can we ablate it percutaneously, put a probe through the skin and into the liver and burn it, well, we can also get our microcatheters again into the liver, into the exact artery that's feeding that HCC, and we can inject focally either radiotherapy or chemotherapy. And you're basically not affecting the majority of the other liver. There's no systemic side effects. It's just killing that tumor alone.
Wow. Just to clarify, what is HCC?
Oh, hepatocellular carcinoma.
Okay. And that's usually like a metastasis.
So yeah, it can be. I mean, it can metastasize. But HCC, hepatocellular carcinoma, is a majority of the patients are cirrhotic, whether it be from drinking, whether it be idiopathic, whether, you know, who knows what it can be from. But that's the majority of patients who suffer from HCC. So that's a common tumor that we treat in the liver. And because we want to help these patients transition to liver transplant, and there's something called the Milan criteria where we try to keep those, the number of tumors and the size of the tumors below a certain number, so we can help them transition to getting a liver.
Got it. What are like the bread and butter procedures that you're doing with most frequency?
Yeah, bread and butter would be like paracentesis or thoracentesis. Patient comes in, big belly, cirrhotic patient, and they're having some shortness of breath. That fluid may be tracking up into the pleural space, or they have a pneumonia causing a pleural effusion. So we can just put a quick catheter in there and under ultrasound guidance, take out whatever the fluid is. That's the bread and butter. And biopsies, fine needle aspirations, those kinds of things.
Okay. And as nurses, this is how we often see interventional radiologists doing procedures are these paracentesis and thoracentesis at bedside.
Yeah. And the other thing that I should mention as well is it's tough to figure out, you know, what exactly was performed, because the majority of the patients that come back just end up with, like, say, a Band-Aid on their neck and that's it, or a Band-Aid on the groin and that's it. There's no big X-lap, you know, scar. There's no big, whatever incision somewhere. So it's tough to really know what did we just do inside the body? Because, you know, they just have a Band-Aid. Say if I were to do a TIPS on a patient, you know, that's could be a 4-hour complicated case it, with general anesthesia. It can be technically a life-saving, case if somebody's bleeding out. But at the end of the procedure, they quite literally just have a Tegaderm on their IJ. And that's it.
That's it. So cool.
You have no idea what just happened.
You can do all these things with just one little hole.
And again, one of the main aspects that I absolutely love about this field. I mean, we've recannulated veins. We've opened, you know, stented up whatever for chronic venous occlusions after, you know, 10 years. And at the end of it, again, just a Band-Aid.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really cool. Yeah. So that kind of leads me to kind of my last general question about IR, which sure. is like how much of your practice is inpatient versus outpatient in the clinic?
It's probably, so clinic, I have 1 to 2 days, either one full day or 2 half days a week, and end up seeing anywhere from, gosh, in a half day, maybe 10 to 13 patients, something like that. And the procedures probably, so we do everything in the cath lab. In my specific practice, we share the lab with the cardiologists and the vascular surgeons, and we just have block times and we add on our cases. And I may be doing half inpatient, half outpatient cases throughout the day.
So you're really ranging from like clinic to most emergencies, right? With GI bleeds. So you're really running the gamut of acuity with patients.
Yep. So it may, and that's sometimes you have to balance out. You have to triage on a day-to-day basis. So I may have 3-4 outpatient cases scheduled. You know, that we've given times to patients, say 8 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 p.m., whatever it may be. And all of a sudden you get a call, hey, there's a GI bleed, or there's a submassive PE, the patient's, you know, who's having difficulty breathing. And so you have to start triaging things. Say, well, you know, everybody needs the best patient care. Everybody's, you know, important when it comes to patients. But, you know, some patients are more critical than others. So you have to start figuring those things out. And it's a day-to-day thing.
Yeah. And that's something that nurses have to talk with our patients about all the time, because, you know, we're at bedside 24/7, with our, I'm talking about, bedside as in, inpatient nursing. So we often have to explain to our patients, you know, why their procedure is getting pushed back, why they're NPO and it's still 3 p.m. and we don't know when they're going to go. And I think it's helpful to listen to you as a physician who's working in the OR or cath lab to explain why, you know, these patients' procedures are getting pushed back.
Yeah. And we, you know, you guys are on the front lines. We appreciate that. And it's very important, because patients, you know, sometimes I'm in the lab for, you know, a 3-hour case. My phone is just going off the hook. I can feel it in my back pocket. I can't scrub out. And, you know, there's things that we just need to, you know, it's again, a team effort for patient care. It's all a team effort. So, and that's why this is so important, what we're doing right now, communication and just education on both of our parts is, you know, back and forth conversation.
Amen. That's what I'm all about.
Yeah.
So let's start to dive into radiology here. Sure. I think it's really handy for me that you have this background in diagnostic radiology, because I just want to ask you some really basic questions. We'll call this like radiology 101 here.
Let's do it.
So there are obviously many different modalities of imaging a patient, like x-ray, CT, MRI, ultrasound. Those are the big ones I see at the hospital. Can you just talk about the difference between all of these modalities and why, like, for example, sometimes you want to x-ray the chest versus other times you want a CT?
So x-ray, when it comes to, say, the chest, the abdomen, or a bone, an arm, leg, whatever it may be, x-ray is really good at detecting air. So if that air is in the lungs or if that air is in the bowel, right? So you get a KUB. KUB is not the best at, you know, detecting specific, but it can tell you if there's an obstruction. It can tell you if there's an ileus. You know, if the small bowel is dilated or the small and large bowel are dilated, that's different.
So for new nurses, what is a KUB?
Oh, yeah. That's basically an abdominal x-ray. Kidneys, urinary, bladder.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So I knew it was abdominal, but I didn't know what the acronym.
Yeah, KUB. So it's essentially an abdominal x-ray. And you get that for, you know, mainly just to check the bowel pattern. Sure, there's instances in the ED if somebody ingested something, a battery, figure out where it is. But you mainly would just want to see which part of the bowel loop is dilated. And you can rotate a patient too to check for free air. Say if they can't do an upright, they can't stand up, to check for free air. Well, you can rotate them left lateral decubitus, and the air can rise up above the liver. You can check for free air that way. So an x-ray is really good at checking for air. It's also good for bone. So if you're getting a KUB for like back pain, essentially you're saying, I need to rule out a pretty obvious fracture. I'm not going to tell anything about the nerve roots at all. It's just bone. And you mentioned, you know, why is a CT chest sometimes done instead of a chest x-ray? Because literally, this is how I describe these imaging modalities to my patients in clinic, is if an x-ray is like painting a picture with a number two pencil. You can get a pretty decent picture, but it's still just a number two pencil. And a CT scan is like painting a picture with like a box of crayon or a box of colored pencils. So now you have different colors. Now your picture is getting a little bit more elaborate. And then an MRI is like painting a picture with a palette of colors. And you are just going to town and you're making this like a Van Gogh. It's looking pretty, pretty nice. So that's kind of the difference between those modalities. A CT scan is very good at checking spatial resolution, meaning can I differentiate point A from point B, which are only 2 millimeters apart? And that's why they're good for pulmonary nodules, because you can really pinpoint exactly how big this nodule is. Okay. So that's what spatial resolution is evaluating the difference between point A and point B, even though they're extremely close to each other. MRI is very good at determining contrast resolution, meaning I can tell the difference between color A and color B. And that becomes very important when you're checking for different things, i.e. cancer, because a different color in the pancreas can mean that's cancer instead of just the pancreas. So that's why MRI is very good at detecting different types of cancer and very, very sensitive at picking up different things.
When you're talking about different color, are you talking about like the, what do you exactly mean by color? Yeah. Like the gradient of what you're seeing?
Yeah. So when I say color, I'm essentially using just a broad term. What the MRI terms would be signal intensity. Is the grayish color of the pancreas versus a brighter grayish color. So that can actually mean a world of a difference. And that's why you have to read thousands of MRIs to get really good at detecting different subtleties. So, and then MRI is really good at the enhancement pattern. And there's different types of signal characteristic of a kidney lesion, kidney cancer. There's different types of renal cell carcinoma. If it's arterially enhancing and T2 bright, again, don't worry about the specifics of what I'm saying, but this is just an example. If it's arterially enhancing and it's T2 bright, this is going to be a clear cell carcinoma versus if it's delayed enhancing and it's T2 dark, that's a papillary cell carcinoma. And those are completely different because one is extremely aggressive. One, you're going to probably live with for 20 years and nobody's going to really care. So that's how good MRI is, where I can actually subtype different types of renal cell cancer. CT, can't really do that. But CT, I can see exactly how big that tumor is. And I can really just mark it down to the size of, you know, a few millimeters.
I see. Okay. I've seen an MRI before and it shows what, you know, I'm going to use like my really rudimentary understanding of MRIs here, but what appears to be like a flip book, right? You know, when we're kids, we have these books that, when you flip through them really quickly, you show what looks to be like an animation. And can you help me with the vocabulary here? Like what is that called when you're able to kind of cut through these cross sections on a patient?
So, it may be from what I think you're saying is, on CT MRI, you're going through like the different cuts as you're scrolling through. It's going through the different like cuts of the abdomen, for example. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So you can have like an axial image, which is essentially cuts through the abdomen, as if I were slicing, you know, a liver kind of in half. You can have a coronal section, which is essentially cutting. It's tough to do this on just audio, but I'm using visual cues right here. So there's different things. You can have coronal cuts, you can have sagittal cuts, you can have oblique cuts. So you can really fine tune exactly how you want that image to be portrayed on your screen. You just work with your technologist and you can have different types of cuts to figure out what exactly you want to look at.
Okay. And this is something that you can do with both CT and MRI.
CT also comes in axial, sagittal, and coronal
okay.
views. Yes.
Okay, but not X-ray.
X-ray is a 2D image of a 3D structure.
Okay.
So sometimes x-rays can be some of the hardest things to read.
Yeah.
So for somebody who knows about x-rays, they can appreciate how difficult a chest x-ray can be. For somebody who is not aware of what subtleties you should be looking for on a chest x-ray, it may seem like the easiest thing to read. Oh, there's the heart. Oh, there's a consolidation right there. And that's it. But the more you read, the thousands or hundreds that you read, you start realizing, well, this little bulge right here shouldn't be here. Or this little indentation right here shouldn't be there.
Yeah. You know, I listened to some physicians' podcasts and they talk about interpreting chest x-rays. And it sounds really hard. Like you take people who are very smart, very, you know, educated, experienced, and they still aren't sure if what they're looking at is pneumonia or not.
Yeah. Yeah. That can be very difficult. And, you know, that's why some radiologists say, you know, it could be pneumonia, it could be some atelectasis, clinically correlated. Everybody makes fun of a radiologist saying that. But in the end of the day, on a chest x-ray, it is very difficult to say, hey, no, this is just atelectasis. Yeah. There's no infection there.
That's so tough. Maybe this is a good point to kind of come back to my initial comparison of a chest x-ray versus a chest CT. So what are some like reasons why you would want a chest CT versus just a chest x-ray?
When you're just really not sure, you get the x-ray and you say, I'm kind of on the fence. I'm not sure. And you really want to nail down that pneumonia. And you want to really nail down that, oh, this is just a pleural effusion, not an empyema. Then you would go ahead and get that CT.
So let's talk about two other modalities, and then I'd like to touch on contrast, sure. Since that's such a big part of radiology. First, ultrasound, when that's indicated, and a PET scan. I'm working at a larger hospital now. I see patients going off to PET scan a lot. Not really sure what it is, so I'm really interested to learn more about that. But let's start with ultrasound. When do you want to get an ultrasound?
Yeah, ultrasound can be a great step one. So, for example, if somebody's ruling out appendicitis in a child, and you don't want to give the patient radiation, you don't want them to go through a CT scan. Maybe the hospital doesn't have the capability of doing an MRI, whatever it may be. So you do a quick ultrasound. There's no radiation involved. It is quick and easy to do. Just an ultrasound probe. You put it wherever you want to look. And you can actually see some pretty good detail. And ultrasound is really good at also catching flow. So if you're looking at arteries, veins, it's really good at figuring out if their flow is even, there. And so that's, ultrasound is really good in that aspect. And then going on the completely different aspect, which is not a step one, but a step five, which would be like a PET CT. So, you know, an ultrasound, you've diagnosed, oh, well, the patient does have some common bile duct dilation. And you say, well, why is that, why is that dilation there? Could this be a stone? Could this be cancer causing this dilation? Well, and then you kind of work up the patient, you realize some of the enzymes or some of the tumor markers, I should say, are elevated. So you say, okay, well, this may be pancreatic cancer causing this dilation. Well, now you're going to step five, you're going to that PET CT scan, and you're finding out, well, is that cancer just focused in that pancreatic head? Or has it metastasized somewhere? And what that is you're essentially providing the patient radioactive glucose. And what likes glucose? Very active cells. So cancer cells are extremely active. So when you look at a PET CT scan, you essentially get the PET portion of it, which lights up areas of highly active cells. And then you fuse it to a CT scan. So now you can figure out exactly where that metastasis is.
Got it. Right. And, one thing nurses have to keep in mind when they're sending patients to PET scan is to not give insulin. So now it makes sense to me that if you're going to be administering this glucose, you want it to be able, to get to these,
correct. Yeah, you want to let it flourish. Yep.
So let's talk about contrast. And I realize that contrast is, could be a whole podcast episode into itself. But what is the role of contrast in these modalities?
So let's go to CT scans. So there's no contrast involved with X-ray. There's no contrast involved right now with ultrasound. I say right now because eventually there will be FDA approval for ultrasound contrast. In some instances, we do use it. But for CT, so CT contrast is the most utilized thing. If the patient's kidneys are appropriate for contrast. And this is a big asterisk what I'm talking about right now, because I can go off on this as well. But if the patient's kidneys are appropriate for IV contrast, please give IV contrast. And no matter what, even if you're, you know, even if you're looking for renal stones, I can still see renal stones, even though contrast has been given. It's just a knee-jerk reaction. Checking for stones, rule out, you know, a nephrolithiasis. Let's do a CT non-con. Contrast allows you to differentiate point A from point B, or, you know, pathology A from pathology B. And you can really define the borders of structures. You can really see the enhancement pattern of structure. And without contrast, you're really hindered. So without IV contrast, you have a subpar CT. So you may find kind of what you're looking for, but you really can't nail down exactly what you're looking for. You may see some stranding, but you know, that stranding may be just physiologic. But you don't really know if that's truly pyelonephritis or if that's just how the patient's kidneys kind of are. So IV contrast really enhances your ability to find pathology. Oral contrast, I don't really care for.
Me neither.
Fine. You want to get oral contrast? Yeah, exactly. You know, that's fine. I mean, oral contrast, it's okay. You know, it can help with finding bowel obstruction. That's fine. But my main thing is please, 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 if the patient is, able to, give the IV contrast.
Anything else you'd like to add to this section here? I don't know if you wanted to dive into that asterisk about contrast
a lot of the initial studies for contrast induced nephropathy, you know, it was back in the day, it was a lot to do with angiograms. It may or may not have been due to just the contrast causing the nephropathy. It may have been due to maybe some plaque that was being showered off into the renal arteries. Regardless, at this point, there have been a lot of studies now that show that, you know, even if you give large doses of IV contrast for CT patients or an angiography, it doesn't really do much for the creatinine or GFR. So you're still probably safe.
All right. So let's wrap up that radiology 101 here. And let's talk about some more specific procedures that you do as a interventional radiologist, and especially ones that, you know, pertain to nurses. When you and I initially talked about, you know, doing the podcast episode together, I kind of posed to you, you know, what's something that you think nurses often get wrong or don't understand? And you mentioned a PEG tube versus a G tube. And I thought this was a great subject because as nurses, we're dealing with these all the time. I had honestly been using these terms interchangeably. They're not the same thing. They're different, and we need to manage them differently. So I'll let you take it from here. What is the difference between a PEG tube and a G tube?
Yeah, oftentimes they are used synonymously. And a PEG tube is percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy placement. So that basically means that a GI doctor has put a scope into the mouth, down the esophagus, into the stomach, and has transilluminated, essentially turned on a little light inside, and has seen that light go to the outside of the abdomen, and then they can stick exactly where that light is. So everything is done endoscopically. A G-tube, the way we place G-tubes, we don't do it that way. We actually put a little nasogastric tube into the stomach, insufflate the stomach to get it real big, and under fluoroscopic guidance, we can insert a tube from the outside in, and we essentially inflate a balloon inside to keep that G-tube tacked in to the abdominal wall, or I should say into the stomach. There are other ways that we can place them as well, but this is the majority of ways that we place them. And why is this important? This is important because after we place these G-tubes, a lot of the times you may see these little tiny buttons that are attached to the patient's skin that sometimes we remove at bedside after a couple of days, or sometimes they just fall off. And if you've ever seen a G-tube, you see that there's a little disc that you're supposed to place all the way down and nice and taut to the patient's skin. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go on a quick tangent here, is make sure that disc is completely taut against the patient's skin. Make sure there is no laxity, and also make sure that there's no gauze underneath that little bumper. And the reason being is that the more taut this bumper is to the patient's skin, what you're essentially doing is you're tacking up that stomach to the wall of the abdomen. a lot of people complain, hey, you know, the G-tube leaking around the G-tube site. Why is it leaking? And then I go up and I check the patient's G-tube and there's a lot of laxity. The bumper may be, you know, a couple of centimeters up. Well, then that balloon inside or that little disc, whatever it may be, is freely flowing in the stomach. It's just kind of moving around. So it's like a ball valve. You want to close that hole with a ball, which is either the disc inside the stomach or the balloon inside the stomach. And the way to close that little valve with that ball is by making sure on the outside that the disc is very taut against the skin. In a G-tube, when I say that there's a balloon, well, this is going to have two different ports on the outside. You'll have a port where you're flushing whatever the feeds, whatever it is, the medication. And you may see another little tiny port that says 7 to 10 mLs. Mm-hmm. And that's the balloon port. So that you don't want to touch. That's something if the patient or you accidentally put a syringe into there and some fluid comes out, you may be deflating the balloon. So that's very important. A PEG tube, which a GI doctor places, does not have that port. There's one single port. You just flush whatever it is and that's it. And removal or exchange of these things is a little bit different as well, because when you remove a PEG tube, there's a little mushroom disc inside. You quite literally have to pull this thing out really hard and it pops out. As far as a G-tube that has a balloon, all I do is deflate the balloon and I just slip the tube right out.
Okay. So I have so many questions here. this just blows my mind. But first of all, let's start with what are the indications for a PEG tube versus a G-tube?
You know, a lot has to do with anatomy. And if the stomach can easily be seen on the outside when I say transilluminate. So they quite literally turn on a little light inside the stomach and they can see that light on the outside of the skin. And if you can easily do that, the patient's not obese, their liver's not in the way, the colon's not in the way, sure, feel free, you know, a GI doctor can place the PEG tube. If there's anatomical issues and, you know, the liver's in the way, the colon's in the way, well, when we put that nasogastric tube, insufflate the stomach to, you know, 4, 5, 10 times the size of what it should be, well, it essentially just pushes everything out of the way. Now we have a nice tract into the stomach.
I see. So it doesn't necessarily have to do with like a long term or short term. It just has to do with like the anatomy of the patient.
Anatomy, yeah. Short term, long term. You know, if somebody's more combative, somebody's agitated, it is a little bit easier to pull out a tube that has a balloon attached to it. So, you know, a PEG tube would be good in that instance. We also do place types of tubes that essentially look like PEG tubes without a balloon. We can place that as well. That's a little bit of a different technique, and we do that on patients who we think would be pulling out their tube in the near future.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were talking about making sure this bumper is flush against the skin and taut, I've definitely seen instances where there's as much as maybe an inch of space between, you know, the patient's abdomen and the bumper. What should we do in that case?
Oh, feel free. Feel free to grab the end of the tube, pull it gently, gently back, as if, you know, it's like a drawstring and you're trying to keep it nice and taut. So pull it gently back. And then get the bumper and just try to slide it gently over the tube and then make it nice and taut against the skin. Not to the point where you're, you know, it's strangulating some sort of vessel in there that it's so tight that, you know, it's causing them discomfort. But, you know, nice and flush against the skin.
I'm trying to think. So you're just saying essentially like push it back in?
So you're pulling back on the tube with one hand and then with your other hand, you're grabbing the bumper and you're pushing forward with the bumper.
Oh, okay. Yep. I didn't know you could do that.
Yep, absolutely.
I didn't know that the bumper like moved independently.
Oh yeah, that's the number one way of treating a leaky tube.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is so great. How did I go for like, I don't know, where am I at? 6 or 7 years of being a nurse and not know some of this stuff? Because I'm dealing with G-tubes and PEG tubes all the time.
Yeah, it's a common issue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you know, if you, as a nurse, if you're dealing with a PEG tube or a G tube in a patient?
Well, number one, the chart's a great friend. but if you don't have that luxury, then number one or number two, I should say now, is checking for that little port, that side port that says 7 to 10 mLs. which would be the balloon port. If you do see that, then it's a G-tube, and it's likely an IR that's placed that. If you don't see that, then the majority of the time it would be likely a GI doctor doing that. Yes, there's a caveat. We do place certain types of tubes that look like a PEG tube, but it's probably a gastroenterologist who placed that tube.
Okay. And why is this important to know as a nurse? Like, how does it change our management of the tube?
Yeah, the main thing would be that side port, and not to mess with that side port, because I've seen it happen where, for whatever reason, somebody has placed a syringe into that side port and has ended up aspirating the air out of the balloon. The fluid out of the balloon, and the tube ends up falling out. And just educating the patients, say, hey, you know, don't touch this, this side port, and educating the family, saying that there is a balloon inside, and this, you don't even touch this portion of the tube.
Got it. And then what do we do if the G-tube comes out, whether it be a confused patient? I mean, it's almost always the confused patient.
That's a very important question. If the G-tube comes out, the very first thing, other than, you know, giving us a call, is to put like a Foley catheter back in the tract. The main thing we want to do is just to preserve the tract. Doesn't matter how small the Foley is, just immediately go to the cupboard, get a Foley catheter, and just shove it right into there, and then tape everything onto the abdomen. Don't leave it in the stomach itself, but have a portion of it in there, and then a portion of it sticking out of the skin, and then tape it onto the abdomen. So that will allow us to get back into the stomach, and the tract won't close up by the time we get to it.
Okay. And if we stick a Foley in there, should we inflate that 10 ml balloon?
Nope.
No. Just no need. We just want to keep that tract open.
Just the tract open. That's
got it.
Yep.
Cool. I've definitely come across this mostly in emergency, where we get patients in for whom they've just pulled out their G-tube.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. Okay, cool. So let's move on to tunneled catheters, which sounds like is a specialty of IR. And, you know, I often see these tunneled catheters on dialysis patients, like new dialysis patients for whom they don't have like a functioning graft yet or a fistula. But can you talk about the indications for a tunneled catheter and also like the basics of what a tunneled catheter is?
Yeah. So let's use that example that you're talking about for somebody who has not had a graft or a fistula created yet for them. They do need to go on dialysis. So the very first thing you can do, and if it's an emergent case, just put a Quinton catheter in, or a, you know, trialysis catheter into the IJ, into the groin, wherever it is, just so you can get them dialyzed, whether it be emergently or just, you know, while the patient's in the hospital. You patient cannot go home with that catheter, because that is a just direct stick into the vein, and that's it. So they can't go home with that catheter. So what we do is we will convert that over, or we'll just go straight to a tunneled catheter. In the majority of cases, we go into the internal jugular vein. So we're actually inserting the catheter into the internal jugular vein, but we're tunneling it underneath the skin, so it pops out of the skin near the chest wall. And that's for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's harder to pull out. There's a little tiny cuff around the catheter that the skin likes to grow around, so it's very difficult to pull that out. Number two, it's very difficult for bacteria to go from the outside world through that 7-centimeter tract of skin underneath, then into the vein, and then systemically into the body. So that's number two. The other thing that I want to briefly touch upon is, you know, if somebody has this catheter, and if I go to the bedside and I remove this catheter, they don't need it anymore, or they just got a graft placed for whatever reason, I pull the catheter out, I actually hold pressure on the neck, because that's where I originally inserted the catheter into the vein. And I always advise my patients, say, I'm going to hold pressure here for 5 minutes on your neck. I'm going to put some gauze, though, where the catheter came out of your skin on your chest. If that gauze in the next couple of hours gets soaked with blood, don't hold pressure over the gauze. That's not where the bleeding is occurring. The bleeding is occurring where I inserted the catheter into the vein, which was the neck. So you can put a sandbag or hold pressure on that chest site for 3 hours. The bleeding won't stop. But you hold pressure on the neck site where the catheter actually originally went into the vein for 5 minutes, bleeding stopped.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I know I've assisted physicians when they remove these catheters, and I remember them saying, like, you got to hold on to this point up here. Sorry, you can't see over audio here, but to where there was that insertion site into the IJ. And it takes a good long time. Like, these are large catheters we're talking about.
Yep. Can take a while. Yeah.
So we see PICCs all the time as nurses. You mentioned that there is such thing as a tunneled PICC. And
yeah,
I don't think I've ever seen these. Maybe I have and I didn't know I was looking at it. But like, at what point would you, is it a tunneled PICC indicated for a patient instead of a traditional?
Tunneled PICC is just a, it's terminology that some people use. Other people call it a tunneled central line. Some people just say a Hickman. So there's a lot of different names for these types of catheters. So a conventional PICC just goes through the arm, usually kind of the medial aspect of the bicep, basilic brachial vein somewhere. And it's a peripherally inserted central venous catheter PICC. Now, if somebody needs to save their veins because they're eventually going to be a dialysis patient, they need to have a fistula created or a graft created, then we want to preserve their veins so the vascular surgeon can create that for them. So we don't insert these PICCs into their arms. So then we perform a procedure just like that tunnel dialysis line that we were just talking about. And we tunnel that catheter from the IJ site down through the chest and it comes out the central portion of the chest. So that's a tunneled central venous catheter or a tunneled PICC.
Got it. What else can we talk about in IR? So one thing you do in IR is put in biliary drains. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly seen these before and I didn't realize that they're two different kinds of biliary drains, or maybe there's more than that, but my experience with biliary drains is that they're external drains, right? So you have a catheter that comes out through the skin of a patient and into a collection bag, I'll call it. But can you explain about, you know, what the indications are first for a biliary drain and that the two different kinds that we can see?
Yeah, so biliary drains, you know, if somebody has an obstruction of the bile ducts, it could be for, benign or malignant, for whatever reason they have an obstruction. And we need to decompress their bile ducts. Their T. bilious high, they're having side effects, or, you know, their skin is jaundiced, their eyes are yellow, for whatever reason. So we can place these biliary drains. An external drain is we just put a drain into the bile ducts and it's just all draining out into the bag. Then there's an internal external drain where a portion of it, yes, is within the bile ducts, but then the other portion of it goes through the common bile duct and then into the small bowel. So even though somebody has a tube in and they're not really draining out into the bag, don't be alarmed because a portion of that may be in the bowel itself and they may be draining internally on their own, which is great. That's the way it should be. So if that were the case, they have an internal external drain. Well, we can even just take the bag off and then quote unquote cap the tube and let them drain internally by themselves and then eventually bring them back and then internalize everything and just put a stent inside.
Okay. So the whole point then of an internal external biliary drain is the hope that you can at some point that the drainage will not collect in the bag, but will remain internally.
Yep.
In the patient.
Absolutely. Yep. You want everything to flow inside the patient. You don't want them to lose their bile.
I would imagine as a nurse, this could cause confusion if you have a biliary drain on a patient and you're getting no output.
Yeah, it can be alarming. It's the same exact thing for nephrostomy tubes. We do have tubes that go just into the kidney, tubes that go from the kidney through the ureter and then to the bladder. So don't necessarily be alarmed if your biliary drain or your nephrostomy tube is not draining to the back. Maybe a component of it that's draining internally on its own.
One element of nursing management of these drains is flushing it. Can you quickly talk about what is involved in flushing these catheters? And we'll stick with the biliary drains and the nephrostomy drain.
Yeah, flushing the catheters, essentially, you just want to get a 10-milliliter syringe and just do not aspirate, just flush into the catheter. And all you're doing is you're just making sure the catheter is patent. The last thing you want to happen is that for that catheter to clog up, it has to get exchanged. So that's all you're doing. Usually my orders are for any sort of catheter is 10 ml flushes TID. And again, all you're doing is just trying to keep this catheter as patent as possible. So whatever issue it is can start resolving.
Dr. Hansara, is there anything else that you would like to add to the episode.
Well, I'd like to add that, again, patient care is a team effort, and we all need to work together. Don't ever be afraid to ask your local interventional radiologist, whoever you work with, any question. It does not matter what it is. You'll know that, you know, everybody in our field, for the most part, is very laid back, very open to, you know, anything. And we love, in our field, we love talking to everybody, patients, nurses, staff, whomever. And we're happy to answer questions. Don't be afraid. Give us a call. I'm happy to, you know, if you give me a call, you know, evening and hey, say, this catheter is not working, or, you know, am I okay to do X, Y, or Z? It's always best to get that question clarified and answered than rather than just go ahead and do it and maybe adverse outcome or occur.
Absolutely. And I try to be honest on with this podcast saying that, wow, I didn't know something that was really basic, because, you know, here I am 6 to 7 years out in my nursing career, and I still don't know some aspects of G-tube management. And especially in IR, when you're doing so many different kinds of procedures, placing so many drains, it's hard to become like a master of all of these as a nurse. And so, you know, have confidence in yourself to just say, I don't know. Can you please teach me?
Absolutely. It goes for, you know, every part of the field. And I do that, from time to time as well. I go to my senior partners and say, hey, you know, what would you think about this? Or what do you feel like would be appropriate in this instance? And again, it always comes down to appropriate patient care. And you want to do what's best for the patient.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Dr. Hansen. This has been really helpful.
My pleasure, Annie. I really appreciate it. Thanks again for inviting me. I hope I clarified some questions. You know, and again, talk to your interventional radiologist and, you know, keep asking those questions.
Will do. Thank you.
Thanks.
If you enjoy listening, you can support this podcast by becoming a member on Patreon or simply sharing with your friends. And don't forget to claim your free CE credit at upmynursinggame.vcuhealth.org. All right, that's it for today. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.